Good day. This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, August 22nd, 2013. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums.
Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, from the archives, excerpts from a conversation with the recently passed Marion McPartland, recorded in Fayetteville in 1990.
Plus, the Cooperative Emergency Outreach moves into a new building after temporarily closing last fall. And an update on white nose syndrome. The fungus that causes the disease has been found in our region.
But first, the Fayetteville Public Library will almost certainly expand onto the former city hospital property. That's after the Washington Regional Medical Center Board of Directors agreed earlier this week to sell the property to the library for $2 million. Bill Bradley, Washington Regional President and CEO, says the board has been considering what to do with the property for about 8 years, long before City Hospital closed, and originally had three community-minded ideas of what could be done with the property.
One was we thought it would make a great park. The location next to the library would have been good for a park. The second thing that we had thought was a good use of the property was, at the time, there was a lot of discussion about a new police headquarters or police station, and we really thought, you know, that might be a good use for it. And then the logical one was, you know, it's next door to the library, and that they might have a need for it, although at the time, you know, there wasn't a lot of discussion about any expansion plans.
Bradley says one of the good things about the transaction is that all parties involved win. The library gets the land for a needed expansion, and the hospital receives $2 million to go toward an expansion of its own. Bradley says the capital will go toward the construction of a neurological institute at Washington Regional, the centerpiece of which is the recruitment of two endovascular neurosurgeons, of which there are only about 100 in the country.
What they do is basically they're able to stent vessels in the brain for the treatment of strokes, to clear the arteries. And there's other things that they do relative to the treatment of aneurysms and things like that, where right now those patients are put on helicopters and sent to Tulsa or other areas, and we'll be able to do that here. We think the area that we'll serve with these physicians here will expand to about 1 million people that with their capabilities.
But before money and land changes hands between the library and the hospital, there are still a few legal kinks to be ironed out in the deal, mostly associated with a clause tied to the deed of the city hospital land, which states that any proceeds from sale of the land must go toward development of the city's hospital.
When the August recess is over in Washington, one issue members of Congress will attempt to tackle is the unresolved farm bill. Arkansas Senator Mark Pryor says that if a farm bill isn't passed soon, the consequences would be disastrous for the economy.
Agriculture, we think of it as kind of a special thing and a special category, which it is, but the bottom line, agriculture is business. I mean, these are small businesses all over the state of Arkansas. Some of these are large businesses that are involved, people like Tyson Foods and others. But if this farm bill does go away, and we're not able to get to a resolution by the end of September, then it is going to be very chaotic for the country.
Senator Pryor noted if a farm bill isn't passed by the beginning of the new fiscal year on October 1st, subsidies for farmers would revert to levels set in the 1940s, and consumers would see increased prices on goods like milk almost immediately. Arkansas Junior Senator John Bozeman is on the conference committee tasked with reconciling the disparate House and Senate versions of the farm bill.
Hopefully we'll get this done, before the time period runs out. If not, have a short-term extension and try and get a farm bill done before the end of the year. It's so important. You know, the name of the game right now is jobs, jobs, jobs. What this does is provide certainty for our farmers so that they can go forward, make the decisions that they need to as far as buying equipment, hiring people, things like that. So it really would be a big boost to the economy.
But reconciling the different versions of the farm bill will be difficult. Among other differences, the House version split SNAP funding from the farm bill, while the Senate version retained the nutrition program commonly known as food stamps.
Rules are being implemented to Arkansas's new voter ID law, which takes effect in January. Yesterday, the State Board of Commissioners approved rules for the law, approved by the legislature earlier this year. Alex Reed, with the Secretary of State's office, says part of that will involve the state providing a photo ID for people who don't already have one.
we signed a contract for the machines that will provide the free cards. And we hope to have those up and in and running by the 1st of December.
Reed says they're also planning ways to get the word out to the public that they will need a photo ID to vote.
We're looking at different PSAs that we're going to record. We're also looking at different things that we can do as far as paid advertising out of our budget. We're looking at billboards, digital ads, and other things like that. Nothing's final at this point. We're just gathering as much information as we can because we want to have the most effective strategy so that we can notify as many people as possible about the new law.
Opponents of the law say it will still end up disenfranchising some voters, particularly seniors and minorities.
Several counties and cities in the area have either completed or will soon hold special sales tax elections this year. Siloam Springs is one such city. Its sales tax election will be held in early September. Holland Hayden, director of communications for the city of Siloam Springs, says the election is not for a new tax, but rather a reallocation of the existing 1 cent sales tax.
Since the inception of the tax in 1978, the allocation was 80% streets and 20% administration. Over the years, the budget for capital needs and public safety has really been tight, to say the least. There have been years where their capital improvement budget was zero. So they've just kind of fallen behind on updating and upkeep of some of their equipment and their facilities. Therefore, we had to find a funding mechanism so that we could increase capital for public safety.
If approved, the new allocation would give 40% of tax collections to public safety, 40% would be designated for streets, and 20% would be allocated to administration. Hayden says, based on this year's projections, the tax generates about $2.8 million annually. The special election will take place September 10th at the Community Building on Olive Street in Siloam Springs. Early voting will start September 3rd at Benton County Clerk's Office, also in Siloam Springs.
The Northwest Arkansas metro area has been named to another national top list. This time, it made the RealtyTrack Best Markets for Health and Wealth. Northwest Arkansas ranked third behind Austin, Texas, and Fargo, North Dakota metro areas. The rankings looked at a range of lifestyle, disease, environmental, economic, and real estate factors in compiling the list. The areas in which Austin and Fargo performed substantially better than Northwest Arkansas include the percentage of residents who smoke, that's about 20% in Northwest Arkansas, and the percentage of residents who have asthma, which is about 10% in Northwest Arkansas.
Because of continuing construction at Fayetteville High School, all ACT and SAT testing will be conducted at alternate locations during the 2013-14 school year. According to the district, all ACT testing will be conducted at Ramey Junior High, and all SAT exams will be given at the A.G. Learley Life Preparation Services Center, and students should select campuses when registering for the exams.
The Northwest Arkansas Naturals chalked up another win last night on the road. The Nats defeated the Springville Cardinals 3-1. Two more games left in that Springfield series before the Nats return to Arvest Ballpark for their final seven home games of the year. Then there will be three games in Little Rock to end the regular season. The Nats are right now one game out of first place.
Mostly clear this evening with overnight lows from 65 in northwest Arkansas to 71 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, Friday, mostly sunny with highs in the low to mid-90s. Tomorrow evening, partly cloudy with lows from 66 to 72.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me on the phone is Michael Tilley. He is the editor and publisher of thecitywire.com. Michael, how are you?
I'm well this morning. How's the world up there?
So far, so good. No real complaints here. Just because I want to make people cringe, we're going to talk about holiday retail shopping in August.
Yes. Well, it's a cool August, so maybe that's okay, but no, it is, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, however you want to look at it, it is a legitimate story. You know, Walmart is, a lot of the major retailers are gearing up to set up these layaway programs to entice consumers to begin their holiday shopping. Like you said, it's not even September 1st. Football season hasn't even officially started yet, and we're talking about Christmas shopping, but, you know, this is... We've heard retailers talk about the tough retail environment and that the consumer is pulling back and you know, I think this is just one of the ways that, you know, if we can entice the consumer to spend more, but to spread it over, you know, a longer period of time, maybe that's how they get back in the store and get product off their shelves.
Well, I mean, when you consider just, like you said, how much of the retail sales it represents annually, of course they're thinking about it a few months out.
Yep, and they want to get, you know, and of course they're all, if the consumer is, like they're saying, and the consumer is cutting back on non-essential spending, then these retailers, online and brick and mortar, are all trying to target, all trying to gain market share in what is a shrinking market for the holiday season. Now, it's yet to be seen. I mean, we'll know come next January, February, what the sales are compared to the previous years. But, you know, from what we're hearing now, the retailers aren't exactly hopeful about Christmas sales.
Well, let's go from looking at the future to something that deals with the past. The city administrator of Fort Smith has that position now for the first time in nearly five decades, has greater authority when it comes to hiring and firing.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It'd be interesting if we could get an honest answer out of City Administrator Ray Gossick as to whether he really wants that authority. You know, Director Pam Weber kind of pegged it. You know, she said that's, there are people concerned that it would just, you know, give him the, he'd just run rampant firing people, hiring the wrong people, whatever. But, you know, whoever, you know, hit it on the head when she said this is going to make his job more difficult. That could really make the job more difficult because, you know, when you have seven board members that make some of those critical hiring and firing decisions, it takes some of the pressure off. You know, if it goes bad, you can say, as city administrator, you can say, well, that was their decision. But now it will be his decision. It was an interesting switch, though. I mean, there haven't been any issues other than, you know, 3 or 4 years ago when they had the drama around the police chief. But that was one event out of, like you said, almost five decades. So it's an interesting switch. There was no push for it, but the board just felt that the city administrator was going to have the responsibility to manage. She should have the authority.
So now, whether we know if he likes or not, he has it.
Yeah, right. So,
good news for the Marshalls Museum this week. They picked up their largest one-time gift yet, $2 million from the Walton Family Foundation.
Right, largest non-public
right.
funds since they started fundraising. And, you know, hopefully this will get them there. They still need, you know, 10 to 15 million just to get started on construction, and they're hoping to break ground next September, which would be the 225th anniversary of the Marshall Service. But they still have a long way to go. You know, one of the things we talked to Jim Dunn, the CEO of the Marshall Museum, the chief fundraiser, so to speak, and he's hopeful that, you know, not only is it $2 million from the Walton Family Foundation, but it's the Walton Family Foundation. So he's hoping that, you know, if they give, then other foundations and other individuals will see that as a mark of the stamp of approval, so to speak, and it could expedite decisions from other foundations and individuals. So that it could, in addition to the value, the $2 million value, that they hope it has that public relations value as well.
Well, and it helped. I mean, there was the boost in every broadcast, print, and web entity, you know, again, reminding perhaps some people who don't live directly in Fort Smith, yeah, there is this huge project underway.
Right, yeah, and that's, I mean, so there's a lot of value in that, and let's hope they can get some momentum going. I mean, it's been, just to be honest, it's been frustrating. I know it's been frustrating for the Marshalls Museum staff, but it's been frustrating for us, the public, to watch because, you know, this was announced in 2007, they formally began the fundraising phase in 2009. So it's been a slower pace of fundraising than I guess we would have hoped.
Well, I mean, there was 2008 in there, and things changed dramatically in the fundraising world in that fall.
Right, right. I mean, yeah, take a 100-year period and try to pick out the years you would not want to raise money. And, yeah, they did it in those. That period.
It wasn't October 1929, but it was close
right.
enough.
Yeah, it wasn't December 1941, but
right.
Yeah, it was a bad deal.
And finally, quickly, if you're a fan of civics and how government works, there was an interesting thing with the Sebastian County Quorum Court and the Hartford School District this week.
Yeah, and if you find someone that can adequately explain that law, let me know. and I'm being a little facetious, but for whatever reason, and this probably begs a story, maybe we should be working on this, but just a series of circumstances in which she had five members of the Hartford School District either forgot to file or didn't realize they were eligible to file for re-election. And so the Sebastian, long story short, the Sebastian County Quorum Court appointed those five members. So, yeah, and it's an old law from the Arkansas Constitution. And, you know, part of when I was editing the story, you know, I was somewhat impressed that when this law was written, someone had the presence of mind to think that this kind of craziness could occur and we need to have something in place for it. So that, to me, that was the more interesting part of the story.
That there was some forward thought there.
Right, way forward thought.
All right, Michael Tilley is the editor and publisher of thecitywire.com. Michael, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome, sir.
Earlier this morning, Fayetteville Mayor Lionel Jordan and dozens of other local residents attended a ribbon-cutting ceremony for Cooperative Emergency Outreach, who recently moved to a new location. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda attended this event and has more.
All right, everybody ready?
All right.
One, two, three.
Although Cooperative Emergency Outreach moved into its new location at 1649 East Huntsville Road and has been serving clients since last month, the organization waited to celebrate its grand opening until this morning. Publicity Chairwoman Annabelle Steelman Berry was one of the dozens of people celebrating the organization's milestone.
Our mission is to try to help people through emergency situations. If you lose your job, don't quite have quite enough money for the rent, then we can step in and maybe pay not all the rent, but you know, a part of it. If your car breaks down, you've got an extra bill and you can't pay the electric bill, then again, we'll step in to help pay that utility bill. We do have a food pantry. As Joe said, last year we provided food to about 10,000 people. So just, you know, if you need gasoline to get to a job interview, we try to help people with whatever they need when they find themselves in that kind of emergency situation.
After an opening prayer, President of the Board Joe Deshawn explained CEO has had a long history of serving the community.
Operations began on the 4th of December, 1990, in space made available to us by the county in the basement of the old city jail. Through the generosity of Washington Regional Medical Center, we moved to 419 Rock Street on the old City Hospital campus and began work there in September of 1995. During the 18 years that we were there, Washington Regional generously provided the building rent-free, maintenance-free, they paid the utilities, and were more than patient to our many requests for help. When City Hospital sold, we learned that we needed to move, and we began looking for a new home. During that period, Washington Regional continued to be very generous and patient with us to delay our eventual departure until we were ready to move in here.
Chairwoman Annabelle Steelman Berry says Washington Regional was very generous in allowing CEO to remain in its Rock Street location until the end of June. She says they found their current space in January, but didn't move in until this summer because the space needed some work.
And then we added, it needed to be have some ramps and be brought up to all the city specifications and ADA specifications. And so we did that. We renovated it, added about 1,000 square feet. That Bank of Fayetteville gave us a line of credit, which we are also engaged in a capital campaign to try to pay for that. We've raised about 35% of the money we need so far. So we're looking for donations anywhere we can get them.
She estimates CEO has about 1,000 square feet more than its previous location. She says there are some other notable features about CEO's new home.
It's bright. That was the first thing that struck us, is that it was bright. There were a lot more windows. It's more spacious. We've got extra room for food storage. We were using sometimes the library for food storage, sometimes private offices or people's garages. Now we have a lot more room for food storage. So
Annabelle estimates CEO serves 100 to 120 families per week, and those clients come from a large portion of Washington County.
There is a lot of need here. I think the economy is improving, but there is still a lot of need. There are probably more homeless people in this area than people realize, and that's another. We have a separate food section that is food for the homeless, you know, so that they can come in here and get food. Sometimes we're able to provide them with a tent or a sleeping bag, something like that. We also provide the pet food. You know, people may, if they're on a really tight budget, they may just barely be able to feed their families, and they don't want to have to get rid of their dog or their cat, so we will provide pet food for them. But there's a lot of need, and we, not just in Fayetteville, we actually serve Washington County, South Washington County, from the Northwest Arkansas Mall south to the Crawford County line. So we it's a fairly big area.
During the ceremony, President of the Board Joe Deshawn thanked all of those who have helped CEO, including the cooperative of 21 churches, who provide the majority of the organization's support.
If you are here, thank you for coming. Whether you are here or not, our heartfelt gratitude goes to you for your continuing support. And to our volunteers. We have 170 volunteers. They devote over 6,000 hours a year to helping our brothers and sisters in the community who need a helping hand. In the last 5 years, we provided over $1 million to help with utilities, rent, prescriptions, clothing, and food. In 2012 alone, we helped 14,000 people and provided a three-day supply of food to 10,500 people. That's just in a microcosm of the impact that CEO has on the Washington County community. A pastor called CEO the gem of Fayetteville, and I totally agree.
More information is available at ceofayetteville.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
In Congress, climate change doubters turn to this expert.
Our first witness is Dr. Judith Curry.
She won't get behind urgent action to reduce carbon emissions, but Curry takes her own steps.
I walk to work. I'm a fanatic about keeping the air conditioning high and the heating low.
A controversial climate scientist, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered this afternoon, beginning at 3 on KUAF 91.3 FM.
In late July, federal and state officials announced that a fungus, which is killing cave-dwelling bats across the eastern United States, has been detected in a private cave in Baxter County and a public cave on Devil's Den State Park west of Winslow. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich takes us there.
Devil's Den State Park Superintendent Monty Fuller hikes up a steep mountainside trail towards Devil's Den Cave. The park's gorgeous this late summer morning, mostly deserted with public school in session. Devil's Den Cave is located only a quarter mile from park headquarters, so it's a very popular spot. Anyone with a flashlight and courage were free to explore the 500-foot-long fissure, but the entrance to this cave and many others on the Ozarks were gated and locked 3 years ago after a highly contagious fungus called Geomyces destructans was discovered in a Missouri cave complex a few hundred miles north. The fungus causes white nose syndrome.
Watch your step. Okay, you can see here beside me is this gate that's physically blocking this cave. This is the main concern is the Devil's Den Cave because it has the most likely environment for the fungus to grow.
Hibernating bats that come into contact with fungus spores, which thrive in cool, dark, wet caves, can become covered with an irritating white powdery residue concentrated on their snouts and wings. White nose syndrome was first documented in upstate New York back in the winter of 2006 after scientists witnessed colonies of bats fluttering out of caves deep in winter in distress. The disease has now spread to 22 eastern, midwestern, and southern states, as well as 5 eastern Canadian provinces, and has killed as many as 7 million bats. Arkansas is among 4 additional states which have tested positive for the fungus, Although no bats have been stricken with the disease here, the disease is spread bat to bat. All sorts of bats inhabit Ozark's karst, an eroded geologic formation pocked with thousands of caves. 60 caves are located on Devil's Den State Park, which staff have been monitoring for years.
In January each year, park staff and biologists for the Game and Fish Commission go into these caves and they count bats by species. We have the Indiana gray bat, Ozark big-eared bats, which are both endangered species. Now we have other species of the big brown bat, the little brown bat, the tricolor, which is also used to be called the pipistrelle. Those are the smaller, physically smaller species of bats. And this fungus attacks the smaller species the hardest.
And although we rarely see them, bats are critical to keeping insect populations at bay.
Bats are very important. You know, they eat a lot of mosquitoes and other insects day and night, mostly dawn, dusk, and at nighttime. Bats are nocturnal animals. There are bat species that are vegetarian. They're pollinators. So, you know, they play a very important role in the grand scheme of our ecology.
The economic value of insect-eating bats to American agriculture is estimated to be $22 billion annually. Bats also devour tons of insects harmful to forests, and their guano, their poop, is essential to the survival of extremely rare cave organisms, such as cave salamanders and fish. Devil's Den Park hosts a bat-o-rama every June to encourage visitors to learn more about bats. Several years ago, staff constructed a bat house demonstration project near the park headquarters. But now that the fungus has been detected in Devil's Den Cave, the task has taken on a certain urgency.
As a environmental manager, it was kind of a wake-up call that, okay, it's here. Deep down, when we've been watching this fungus as it spread west, deep down, I think we probably, if we would admit, we knew it would be here at some point. It's just a matter of when.
But with funding from the National Science Foundation, a coalition of federal and state agencies, coordinating with the University of California, Santa Cruz, and Northern Arizona University research teams are tracking the spread of the disease. Arkansas Game and Fish Commission is also on task, led by non-game mammal program leader Blake Sassy, who's been looking for evidence of the disease in Arkansas, he said, since 2008.
Now, we conducted the sampling for that study as part of our regular monitoring activities. So we were doing this in caves that we were going to be at anyway. And basically what it was, there's a large Q-tip, basically, that we moistened and then rubbed that on the bat's nose and its wings, and then we sent that Q-tip back to the lab for testing to see if the presence of the fungus could be detected. And we used that same methodology to look for fungus on the rocks right underneath where the bats were roosting.
And the Ozarks Plateau is a particularly sensitive ecoregion to this pathogen.
Well, there's been somewhere over 3,000 caves that have been mapped and described in Arkansas, and which is makes us one of the more cave-rich states in the country. However, as far as a bat point of view goes, we only monitor probably, depending on the year, 30 to 75 of those caves every winter. So, you know, finding the fungus associated with white-nose syndrome or white-nose syndrome itself, it can be quite difficult with all those potential caves that could be used by bats out there.
The Arkansas Game and Fish Commission has been working closely with U.S. Forest Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and state parks, monitoring bat populations' health, as well as tracking endangered bat species, such as the Ozark big-eared bat.
Well, we've got 16 different species of bats here in Arkansas. Some of them are only found down in, you know, bottomland hardwood swamps, while others are really only found up in, you know, the cave areas of the Ozarks, and some kind of go down into the Ouachitas where there's some abandoned mines.
And with Arkansas bats now under threat, authorities will concentrate monitoring.
Well, we're going to return to the caves where the fungus was found this winter to see if it actually has developed into white-nose syndrome. And we'll probably continue to take more samples from the bats like we did in the last two winters to kind of see if the presence of the fungus has increased over that time period. We'll also go out and survey caves in the vicinity of the ones where the fungus was found to see if it may have spread beyond there since the fungus was identified.
The mortality rate among hibernating bats infected by white-nose syndrome can be as high as 100% in a colony. It's too early to tell, but researchers are trying to determine if ecoregions such as the Ozarks, which tend to be warmer in winter, may not be optimal environments for Geomyces destructans to thrive. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is a Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Tuesday night, Marion McParland, the longtime host of NPR's Piano Jazz, died at age 95 at her home in Port Washington, New York.
She was interviewed by Robert Ginsberg when she came to Northwest Arkansas, I guess Fayetteville, really, mm-hmm. to perform with the North Arkansas Symphony Orchestra. That was in March of 1990.
Right. She actually was here in March of 1990 and then came back to perform in 1992. Robert interviewed her both times. March 1990 is what we're going to hear something from that interview here. At that time, Piano Jazz had already been on the air for more than 11 years. It was one of the more venerable NPR shows, even in 1990.
She said 14 years, actually, in the interview.
She does in the interview, but I went back, and it's funny that you mentioned that, because I hear her say that in the interview. I said, well, and it was 1978 when it started.
Okay.
But
checking her math.
Yeah. During the interview with Robert, she talked about several things that we won't hear about in this excerpt. How she met her husband, musician Jimmy McParland, how she became interested in both classical and jazz as a teenager, and how the industry shifts of the time. There's a great conversation that Robert and Marion McParland have, remembering it's 1990, about how the music world was changing. And they mentioned specifically MTV, which has nothing to do with music anymore.
No.
But with the benefit of hindsight, listening back and knowing how much more it would change relatively quickly. This was before digital downloads were even a blip on the radar screen. Now, part of that will be heard when Robert plays a longer excerpt Friday night on Shades of Jazz at 10. But here's just a bit of what they talked about in March 1990.
I don't know. I noticed some people in the business are trying, sort of have this attitude, some of the younger guys. Like, I've had some people on Piano Jazz, like Benny Green, you're familiar with him. Mm-hmm. He's got quite a young kid, but he really is into the music of Monk and Bud Powell and everybody, sort of as if he were delving into classical music. It's really becoming like that with a lot of players.
Same with Marcus Roberts.
Yeah, Marcus Roberts is another one. And this even younger kid, Jeff Keyser. There's a lot of them out there that are really sort of getting into the repertoire of older jazz. Well, of course, the prime one is Wynton Marsalis. He surprised me. We went to hear him at the Vanguard, and he played a Louis Armstrong tune, Big Butter and Eggman. And then he played some other things from that era, and he really has been listening to that era of music, and he's trying to promote it or tell people they should be listening to it, and they should. I mean, I don't mean as a steady diet, but as part of jazz history.
And then how did you get involved with NPR, with Piano
Well,
Jazz?
Well, that came, I think, as a result of, I don't know if you ever heard the show by Alec Wilder. It was a wonderful series of, unfortunately, Alec in his lifetime was not too well known. It's just a shame because he was such a great composer. And he wrote this book on American popular song, and it was kind of a critique of all the great songwriters, Harold Arlen, Cole Porter, Jerome Kern, et cetera, et cetera. So when the book came out, they started this radio series for NPR in which Alec would discourse about various composers, and they would always have a singing guest. They had Tony Bennett, they had Margaret Whiting, they had Peggy Lee, they had, you name it, jazz, pop kind of vocalists on the show. So when the series ended, they were sort of casting around for something erudite, you know, that wouldn't be too commercial. And I think Alec recommended me. This is what came about. They started asking me, they being the people at Educational Radio in South Carolina, saying we want to do something on the lines of Alec's show. And I just thought it would be easy to do two pianos, have a guest, and we'd talk and play. And I thought it was going to be for, you know, 13 shows and I thought that would be the end of it. But Exxon sponsored it, Baldwin provided the pianos, and here we are 14 years later, and Exxon is still sponsoring it, and Baldwin is still providing the pianos.
Before that interview, you actually mentioned digital download,
mm-hmm.
and in this day of, we record all of our interviews on digital recorders.
Right.
And that interview was actually recorded on
cassette.
Right.
It was a Marantz cassette recorder. And in fact, Wednesday morning, Robert sent me a text, something else you wouldn't have done in March 1990, saying that he had this interview, but it was on cassette. How can we get it into digital format? Like, well, we have nothing up here that makes that transformation. He figured it out at his own house. But yeah, we used to do everything on cassette. Robert still has some reel-to-reel interviews he's done.
Wow.
Yeah.
That'd be fun. Well, you can hear more from Robert Ginsburg's interview with Marion McPartland on Friday's edition of Shades of Jazz, 10 o'clock.
That's correct.
So we're going to fold that down about an inch, and we're just going to stitch it with a straight stitch on the sewing machine.
Libby Osborne, a certified sewing instructor, demonstrates how to sew a pocket for a red and white baby's bib at the Olive Loom in Fayetteville. Her student pays attention and tries on her own. The idea is for the student to pick up the skills and take them home in order to make items, like these bibs, for Olive Loom's brand, From Jane. Olive Loom, which manufactures hand-sewn apparel and accessories, was started about 3 years ago by a mother and daughter duo, Lou Sharp and Leah Garrett. Leah, who has been sewing off and on since a seventh-grade home economics class, fell victim to the job market after graduate school and began helping her mom, who sewed and sold aprons.
So my mom started sewing, you know, as I said, when her she had to take care of her mother and she retired. And so we started selling stuff out of hair shops, you know, like Chrissy's. It was growing really quickly. And I was like, well, we should move this to the farmer's market because the farmer's market, the Fayetteville farmer's market provides a great opportunity for people to sell their homemade stuff. And so we started doing that and it started going really well. And people liked to pick out their fabrics and then people wanted things altered and then they wanted embroidered and it just started growing from there. And we opened Olive Loom.
The name comes from Leah's fondness for the word olive and loom, an item that weaves the fabrics they sew into beautiful garments. They have been at this location in a small shopping center in North Fayetteville for about a year and a half. What began at hair shops has grown to include more than just the Fayetteville Farmers Market. Olive Loom also sells skirts, bags, aprons, and more at Bentonville First Friday and a few stores across the state, along with custom orders. The orders were coming in, and Leah and her mother found that they could no longer keep up with it.
So we have women in Winslow and Fayetteville and Farmington and Springdale that help us sew stuff when we need them. And so Jenny's come along to help us instruct women on how to do certain things. And we have a partnership with the Winslow Economic Development Center. And so they provided machines at Ozark Folkways. And so we go out there once or twice a month and teach more skills to these women so they can, you know, of course, you know, make things for us, and then they can, you know, sew for their children and their grandchildren and for themselves.
Olive Loom is now restricted to custom orders, but From Jane is their brand. From Jane is for women by women, hence the Jane, and aims to build communities by empowering women.
A lot of these women that help, that work with us, you know, they use this extra money to pay, like, for medication and pay for propane for the winter and stuff like that. So it's helping them provide more money for their families. Like, we have one lady whose husband was a pastor and he got laid off. And so she works full time, but she does this on the side just to make some extra money. So it's letting people, women, really do, you know, some extra for their families.
This is Leah's mom, Lou Sharp's, favorite part, helping women find their talents. She says she feels good knowing that women, they have about 25 home sewers, are able to earn income they couldn't previously, watching them gain the ability to support their families through money and gifts. Lou started sewing in 4-H Club as a child.
I remember making my school clothes, my dresses. Back then we had to wear dresses to school, and I do remember, I have a picture of me sewing a blue dress, an A-line dress, and having to model it at the county fair, and it was 100% cotton. Yes, and it was in the paper. But I remember Mother making, I was one of five kids, and we showed cattle, and she made matching turquoise bell bottoms, matching turquoise plaid shirts, and all of us had matching straw turquoise hats that we all wore to show our cattle.
Lou also sewed the clothing for Leah and her sister as kids. But as her career as a nurse advanced, she lost the time for the hobby, picking it up again, as we mentioned, upon retirement. Lou never dreamed that it would grow into a thriving bricks-and-mortar business. Having never been on the retail side of things, Lou and Leah entered the Northwest Arkansas Startup Cup last year, coming in first place.
You know, it really pushes you forward because the way to win the Startup Cup is you have to really be applying all these things you say you're going to do, and it really focuses you on, like, what you're doing.
So you really get your mission statement done. You really get out there and market. You really fine-tune things, and it's strategically designed to move you to action, and as well flex your plan if you need to, you know, to meet market demand.
Might start out with one business model, and by the time you're done, it's like not completely different, but, you know, different,
a little bit different. Yeah. You know, but the judges, I mean, it was really a good learning experience, and I mean the other people in the competition were good start entrepreneurial ventures. But the judges were all local CEOs and professors and people that were in the entrepreneurial field. So it was really helpful for them to ask us questions and for us to learn how to
and be like, oh,
them.
I never thought about that, you know. Mm-hmm. What's your revenue streams? Oh, you know, like.
Olive Loom now has a third-party sales rep that works with small artisans. And as a result, From Jane products will be in at least 6 stores in the state by the end of the month. The front room of this storefront serves as a retail space for their products.
And then these skirts we sell like crazy. I'm out of them, and I'm waiting on my fall fabrics to come in. And they're layered and very cute. Well, I call it a boho skirt. And I've sold, well, a lot. So that's good. And online and in Bentonville, and I've had some women buy 4 because they're awesome. And then we do, like, you know, all these aprons and these pillowcase dresses. And these ones I think will be very hot item, the Arkansas ones.
In a variety of colors and textures, they also sell scarves, bags, dresses, coasters, plus custom ukulele cases made out of jackets, custom fishing nets, and coffee cup sleeves, which are easy for beginning sewers. The back rooms of this building are where the sewing and the teaching happens. On sewing machines and sergers, people can learn how to stitch.
Like, this is a rolled stitch, you see? It's cut and rolled under. And then this is like a regular flat log stitch, you see? And then, let's see. And this is just, you know, hemmed with a sewing machine. So, well, this one has like the rolled hem.
This idea of using home sewers is unique. Olive Loom has been approached by people in St. Louis, Louisville, and Boulder who want to sew for them. But in an effort to pace themselves, they have yet to start new clusters.
But we are about creating jobs, and they're From Jane's products that are made by Janes in the local community it's empowering women and supporting their local economies and their local communities.
Lou Sharp and Leah Garrett are the mother-daughter duo behind Olive Loom in Fayetteville. To learn more about sewing classes or From Jane products, visit oliveloom.com or search Facebook. This is Ozarks at Large.
It is Thursday, August 22nd, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us, Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Confession time. This will come as a shock to many people who know me.
All right.
I always dreamed of my daughter being in a pageant. Not a surprise, right?
Right.
I know you love the Miss Arkansas pageant.
I do. But this is not something you really expect to happen when your little girl has special needs. Mm-hmm. But Saturday, and Amanda and 50-some boys and girls like her will appear in the second Northwest Arkansas Angels pageant.
Where is this happening?
This happens in Bentonville at the Assembly of God Church. It was created by a mom named Daphne England so her beautiful 15-year-old daughter Morgan could have the pageant experience. Morgan has cerebral palsy. Mm-hmm. Amanda is developmentally delayed. Many of you know about her as the little queen. Doesn't matter. Neither does age or gender. Anyone with special needs can sign up to compete. Mm-hmm. And there really is no competition because everybody wins. The girls all get a crown and a sash and
Aww.
A goodie bag.
This is great.
And the boys all get a trophy and a sash and a goodie bag and a T-shirt. And they all walk the runway. And mom and dad get to pick the titles that the kids will be awarded.
Nice.
So Morgan's last year was Miss Woo Pig Suey Razorback Princess.
Do we know what Amanda's?
Amanda's will be the little queen of hearts.
Oh, I like that.
Really, you should go if you don't know anything about kids with special needs.
Just show up and support, right?
Show up. You'll cry like a baby.
And it benefits.
There is no...
The people
yeah,
there.
It benefits
yeah.
the...
Okay,
the
yeah. okay.
It's a nonprofit organization that simply gives back to the mm-hmm. kids. 1 o'clock Saturday at First Assembly of God in Bentonville. As near as I can tell, Amanda's age division should be on stage about 3:45. Admission is free. The pageant is closed for this year, obviously, right. to entrance. But sponsors for next year are always welcome. And you can email NWARK Angels.
NWARK
Angels. At yahoo.com.
All right. Thank you, Becca.
Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
On the next Radiolab.
Patient Zero.
Patient Zero.
Patient Zero.
Was probably a Bantu man.
Patient Zero was a man.
He kills a chimpanzee. And he cuts himself.
From the first HIV infection to the first high five.
Give him the high five handshake.
I had that feeling before everybody else did.
That's the moment. That's the moment it begins.
You can listen to Radiolab this Saturday at noon here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
Well, this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us, Katie Hendrickson, who you know as the host of Note every Monday through Friday 11 and of Sunday Symphony Sunday nights at 7. But you're also the musical editor of Rumpus.
Yes.
Rumpus is?
The Rumpus is based in, well, it's based, home base in San Francisco, but there are editors all over the country. It's mostly a literary website. Therumpus.net is actually where you can go to visit it. Features lots of interviews with literary authors and book reviews. And I came on as the music editor to feature music.
And with your position there, last month you went to the Pitchfork Music Festival in Chicago.
Yeah, that was really fun. I saw that Bjork was headlining Pitchfork this year.
Did you see Bjork?
And I saw Bjork. She's one of my earliest music idols, like one of the first rock stars that I kind of really idolized. And I'd never seen her live before, and I got to do that.
I'm
so
incredibly jealous.
The swan dress.
That's what everyone remembers,
yes.
of course, from the Oscars when... Yes. Now, while you were at Pitchfork, you were obviously doing reporting for the Rumpus, but you took along a recorder.
I used my phone to get some captured
sure.
found sounds. I actually had a little mic that I plugged into it so I could catch a little more sound. But there are also, it's in Union Park, so and there's the L train runs right along it, and there's three stages at this festival, and also there's also a book fort where there's literary readings. I actually got to give a reading while I was there, and then there's all these food vendors, there's a craft vendors, there's a whole record shop, so it's turned into this like little village for the weekend. And there are so many fascinating sounds just all around. And if you stand in the middle, you could hear things going on all around you.
Well, you're going to let us stand in the middle here now for the next minute or so, right?
Yep. I put together a little sound collage for you.
You'll hear the L in here, I think.
Yes, the N.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by Ozark Natural Foods, Northwest Arkansas's consumer-owned food co-op since 1971, offering local organic produce and all-natural groceries, bulk foods, health and wellness products, and a full-service deli. Ozark Natural Foods is located in the Evelyn Hills Shopping Center or on the web, ozarknaturalfoods.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Lowell.
L-A.
Lowell, Arkansas, right. A lot of people from southern Arkansas will joke that they are from L.A., lower Arkansas.
Right. I think that's funny. Fayetteville Roots Festival begins today.
Tonight is the first sort of the VIP sort of thing. If you got the whole package, you're there or on your way there. If this is the evening,
right,
you're getting ready. Tomorrow at noon, live broadcast, Ozarks at Large, Fayetteville Public Library.
Very exciting. This is the second year.
Yes.
That we have done this, and we were commenting this morning that we're a little bit calmer than we were last year.
Why did you just say that on the air?
I had to.
We know that physically we're in good hands, that Brian Hembree and the folks at the Fayetteville Public Library have us technologically set up. We've got all the guests set up. Studio audience, we expect you to be there. The broadcast starts at noon. Actually, the real live broadcast part at 12:06.
Right.
Because after NPR News, we've got live music. We've got guests. Becca will join us on stage to give us kind of the weekend roundup.
But it doesn't stop at 1 o'clock.
No. Now, the broadcast does, but we've got music that will go almost all the way up until 2. And then the doors open at Walton Arts Center at 2 for more music there. So what we're going to try to do is, if you're in for the Roots Festival, come hang out with us at the library for live music and fun and some prizes until just before 2, then cruise on over to Walton Arts Center and keep going. And if you're not doing the whole thing, this is a free way
That's
to see some of the music.
I was going to say, yeah. The kicker there is you can see these bands for free.
Right. We're going to have at least 4 different bands that are participating in the Roots Festival, playing live, a couple songs each, some conversation. Going to be great. Also at the library, also live on KUAF, Sunday afternoon at 3, the first ever live broadcast of Tales from the South. That will begin at 3 at the library.
Right. That is a sort of stories recorded by KUAR.
Right. And a couple of the musicians from the Roots Festival will be participating in that as well. So more. And that's free.
More free music.
Right. And Sunday morning at 9, you and I host Weekend Ozarks at Large, and we're including all of the healthcare reform reports that Jacqueline Froelich has done, an overview of what the Affordable Care Act will mean for Arkansas.
Right, leading up to the final story on Tuesday.
Right. Other than that, we're doing nothing. Well, actually, that's not true, because Antoinette and I are going to be the onstage MCs for Friday and Saturday night's editions of the Roots Festival. Other than that, we're not doing anything.
Right. I'll be watching from the audience.
Okay. Have
so
a good
excited.
Time.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Have a good Thursday.